This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
A new wave of technology companies like Airbnb, TaskRabbit, Lyft, and Uber have made headlines as an alternative to huge corporations and big bureaucracy. It's given itself the name the sharing economy. A new book by Tom Slee looks under the hood of the sharing economy to see what's really driving these businesses. In What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy, Slee delivers a sharp critique, asserting that these companies damage rather than serve the interest of communities. Tom Slee writes about technology, politics, and economics. He has a PhD in theoretical chemistry, a long career in the software industry, and his book, No One Makes You Shop at Walmart, is a game theoretical investigation of individual choices that has been used in university economics, philosophy, and sociology courses. And he joins me from Ontario this morning. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Lorraine.
Can you describe the range of businesses that come under the umbrella of what's been called the sharing economy?
Yeah, it's a loose term, so it's a changing configuration of businesses, but it started off with some ideas about very neighborhood kind of things like sharing tools. There are tool sharing libraries and so on. Where it really started to pick up was when I would say you highlighted three individual areas that have really picked up. So one everyone knows is Uber and the whole ride sharing, if you like, and you know, we can put that in quotation marks or whatever, that whole business. Then there's the Airbnb and the short-term vacation rentals. And then there's odd jobs and cleaning services and delivery services where people can, you know, ask for deliveries or odd jobs through an app, so TaskRabbit is an early one of those, and there are companies like Handy and so on. And then this whole other area around the edge of that, people will talk about peer-to-peer lending as an instance of the sharing economy, and on it goes. But as you say, the central parts have been Airbnb and Uber, and then there's this whole constellation of other businesses around them, really.
Well, I appreciate you're also saying sort of like in quotes thing, and I appreciate that your book didn't use sharing economy in quotes all the way through. So even though I think you're distancing yourself from that description.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's one of those things. You can't get too caught up in the pedantic meaning of words, but it's a nature of Silicon Valley that businesses pivot and change what they're doing, and these businesses have certainly done that. They've moved away from a community focus to a growth focus, to a focus on profit, and to being far more, a regular money-making business. So I think we have to acknowledge that that's happened. At the same time, not get too caught up in what words to use.
Well, let's look at Airbnb, because it's one of the most high-profile, and certainly it's got a certain profile in Vancouver. There's a bit of pushback against it here. What path did it take from the time it was a simple idea to provide some cheap accommodation for peers who were coming to a conference to the global enterprise that it is today?
Yeah, well, as you say, that's how it started out. I mean, the name comes from Air Bed and Breakfast. So the idea was, well, it started off when three design people in the design industry had a conference coming to town in San Francisco, and they said, looking for money to help pay the rent, maybe we can blow up some airbeds. People will pay us a bit of money, they can stay over for the conference. So they did that, and then they thought, hey, maybe there's a business in this. And they started to approach venture capitalists to get some funding for it, you know, and they worked hard, and then it grew, and then it really took off, right? So then what's happened over the last 3 or 4 years, as it's just grown exponentially each year, has been really a change in the nature of that business. That original idea of just a shared bed in a, you know, not a shared bed, but a bed in a shared room, if you like, that's no longer really a significant part of their business at all. It's a couple of percent. Even the idea of, the private room in a home, as opposed to, you know, that, which is, I think, how most of us think of a shared arrangement, that, you know, putting someone up in a spare room, that's really maybe 20-30% of their business. Most of their business now is whole home rentals, and a significant portion of that, maybe 40% of that, is people who are renting out multiple homes. So that's where the tension comes. As you say, certainly I know in Vancouver it's been a very big issue, and in other cities around the world as well.
Well, let's explore that a bit. So it's caused a quite a negative reaction in a lot of cities and in their neighborhoods. What are some of the problems that renting homes to tourists has caused?
Well, you know, it's odd. I do a little bit of data collection to try to see what's going on in cities around the world. And as a result, I tend to get emails from people who are concerned about what's happening in their city. And I get, I would say, every week it's a, you know, you hear a different kind of story. But for example, I hear from people in Bordeaux, in Lisbon, in Barcelona, you know, a lot of the European tourist centers. And what they're all saying is, look, we've always had tourists, and tourism has exploded over recent years, not just because of Airbnb, but because of like low-priced travel and so on. But what we're seeing here is that whole areas of the town are getting taken over by vacation rentals, and locals are getting priced out of the market. It's changing the character of the city, and so on a tourist side, what is happening is it's eroding the very qualities that brought people there in the first place. And so at the extreme, what people are worried about is a sort of Disneyfication thing where you end up with a city that is purely a tourist destination. You know, people have to live there as well, and local city governments have to have a way to make sure that it's affordable and livable for the actual residents of the city.
And what about in buildings themselves, where people are, you know, maybe your building, there's a suite that's being rented out on a regular basis to a tourist. What kind of issues happen there?
Well, I think it's one of those things where, you know, if someone in your building does that once in a blue moon, no one really cares that much, right? I mean, that's part of living in a building. But then, if it starts to spread, it becomes an issue. So scale is what matters here. You know, it starts, if you get a few people, if you get a few, and I know there have been stories in Vancouver of like 10 apartments out of 60 getting rented out on a regular basis. And then all of a sudden, you know, in a building, you don't know who your neighbors are, you don't know who's coming and going. And of course, there's always the problem that, you know, people are coming here for a good time, not necessarily for to live there on a permanent vacation, on a permanent basis. So there's late-night parties and so on. So there's all kind of tensions that can come between residents and tourists when they're all mixed together in a way that really no one can control.
Now, one of the things that I found really interesting reading your book is that was to sort of think about some of the narratives that are being told here. And Airbnb is very good at telling stories about you know, creating a home anywhere. How do these stories of helping people just to kind of pay for their suite and bring in a little extra money, how do they stand up against the data?
I think they are effective for a start. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that because that's how you understand the world that we're in. You know, we say, does that make sense to me? Yes, that makes sense. I hear a story. It communicates, and that's why they use them. I think with Airbnb, you know, that is that they tell a small segment of all the stories you could tell about that ecosystem, that company, and its clientele. You know, it's not that the individual stories are false in themselves, but there are many other stories that you could tell as well that they just don't talk about. You know. So they talk about the hosts who earn a little extra money and are able to pay the rent as a result, you know. But they don't talk about people who are driven out from their apartment in order to make room for vacation rentals. They don't talk about you know, people who are running a number of these as a business and getting by because they don't have to undergo the same health fire inspections and registration process that bed and breakfasts do. So, you know, they're very selective about what they tell. It's not that they lie, but it's that they present, you know, a very efficient, marketed version of the truth.
Now, many people, you know, like you and I, look for unique, affordable vacation accommodation that's close to both the landscape and the culture of the place that we're visiting. Is Airbnb somehow filling that gap, or is it displacing other alternatives?
Well, I do think it's doing something. I mean, from the tourist's point of view, it is often a fine experience, right? I mean, what's not to like? But I think when we and I'm not here to knock people who've used Airbnb, by the way. You know, I have friends who've done that. It's, you know, it's not caused a wedge in our relationship or anything. So that's not the point of the book. But the point is that when you undertake those, you kind of assume implicitly that it's being done in a way that is sustainable in the place that you're going to visit. And, you know, and as tourists, we're often not in the best place to judge if that's actually the case. So I think what's happening here is Airbnb does have a nice value for the people who are using the service. But what those people who use the service might not realize is that in many cases it's just not held together in the host city. It's eroding some of the nature of that city that they're visiting.
Well, you describe when you were growing up experiences in the UK of visiting sort of little local kind of areas. Do we know whether Airbnb is causing sort of an erosion of those things or competition for those kind of services that might be paying things that support the local tourist centers and so forth?
I think this is one of the reasons that the Airbnb debate is a difficult one. So you're right. You know, I grew up in the UK. I'm in my 50s. You know, so I grew up, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and it was a common thing then to stay in bed and breakfast or so on as part of your vacation. And that's what we did, like many other families. You know, I think there's a certain informality to that. So I think there's a couple of things. One is, though, I think if you look at Airbnb's business, it is actually very concentrated in big cities, even more than the hotel business. It's, you know, the major tourist centers are where it makes a large part of its money. I think if you look in the U.S., it makes 50% of its income from the top five cities. So it's a very concentrated business. And it's those tourist areas that we've already talked about that are getting eroded. Now, then you're asking, well, what about all these other places, you know, out in the country where it's less, that there's less scale, there's less pressure in that way? You know, and I think the question there is, it's not going to have the same kind of erosion effects, but one of the questions there is, how do we expect those places to be run? You know, do we want bed and breakfasts to have, you know, fire inspections, for example? Do we want there to be a registration process? And I think one thing we've got to ask there is, what happens when things go wrong? Because that's where a lot of the sharing economy companies make a lot of money, is that when things go wrong on an Airbnb visit, it's not Airbnb's responsibility, the way they define it. And I think that's a problem for communities, it's a problem for hosts, and it's a problem for guests in the long run.
Let's turn to transit and transportation. There were some early experiments with ride sharing and car sharing that preceded the current iterations of Lyft and Uber. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all, again, part of the reason that this has grown is that there's a natural appeal to some of this. I mean, many of us, you know, we might have been students and shared rides off the student ride board. You know, where I went to university, people would regularly just hitchhike to get the university was a bit out of town, and, you know, people would just hitchhike out to the university. So there's been a lot of ride sharing gone on in an informal way, and of course carpooling efforts around cities as well. So it's a thing that people understand and people can see the benefit of. So then what happens is, as the bigger companies came in and as venture capital said, you know what, we want to make a multi-billion-dollar business out of this, how do we do it? I think what happens then is that forces a change. And what they found was that there's not enough money in that casual, actual sharing of cars business to make it worth their while. You know, they're after building a business that has the same kind of scale as General Motors, right? So they're not interested in student ride shares in the end. what they said afterwards is, we are going to go after people driving other people for money. We're going to use a market approach. We're going to make money out of it because we don't have to follow any regulations. And we're going to see if we can drive that as hard as we can. And that's what they've done. So Uber has $8 billion worth of cash to pay with. And it's saying that is a very big bet that it can change the rules in cities around the world in order to drive profits for its investors. So it's really changed 180 degrees, if you ask me, from some of those early ideas about, hey, people often share rides for pragmatic reasons, you know, maybe we can do something with that, to can we build a globe-straddling company that will manage transportation in cities around, you know, on continents around the world.
And I was surprised by the actual the size of the worth of companies like Uber.
It is quite phenomenal, isn't it, that Uber now, there are two surprising things about it. One is that they're still privately owned companies, right? So, and that's important. Airbnb and Uber are both, they neither of them have issued public shares. So what that means is they don't have to show their books to anyone, right? So we don't know what's going on inside those companies, which when you're trying to change rules around the world, I think that's something to know. It's a black box. We can't tell what's going inside. But now, if you look at Airbnb's current market valuation, and that's like based on what they've been trading, how they've been selling on private markets, they're part pieces of the business, you know, they are now valued around $25 billion, and that's about the same valuation as the biggest hotel chains in the world, the Marriotts of the world and that kind of company. Uber is valued even higher, about $60 billion, and that's about the same value as General Motors, you know, the big car companies, Ford. So although they're very young companies, there's also a huge amount of money at stake in them making a profit. So there's going to be a lot of push there to, as I say, to change rules in cities around the world in order to drive a profit for those companies.
Tom, you say in the book, Uber's success comes from being parasitic on the cities in which it operates. Expand on that thought.
Well, you know, there's a number of ways in which that happens. But, you know, let's take a single one. Let's take taxes, you know. So here, you know, I'm in a small town, Kitchener-Waterloo. If you take a taxi ride, then the taxi company will collect HST on that ride, right? So what about Uber? Well, it doesn't pay any attention to HST from its drivers. It basically says that's their business, and it knows full well that, you know, drivers are just trying to get by, try to make a living, and it's going to be tempting for them not to pay up on the HST. And then Uber's own portion of this, and I might say that Airbnb does something very similar, is very sophisticatedly arranged to avoid taxation. So when you book an Uber ride in Canada, you don't do it with Uber Canada. You're booking a ride with Uber BV, which is an Uber subsidiary based in the Netherlands. So there's no tax paid in Canada on that transaction, on Uber's part of that transaction. And then you might say, well, at least it's getting taxed in the Netherlands, because Uber BV must be raking in money from stuff around the world, so they must pay tax on that. But they don't, because it turns out they have a cost as well, and that cost is licensing Uber's own software from another subsidiary called Uber International. And that, by coincidence, just balances out the money they make. So they don't pay any taxes. And you think, well, Uber International must pay some tax. But they don't, because that's why they set up in the Netherlands, because licensing IP is turns out not to be a taxable thing in the Netherlands. And they're based partly in the Netherlands and partly in Bermuda. So then they can shuffle the money around to Bermuda. In the long run, they've set up these very sophisticated mechanisms to avoid taxation in the cities where they operate. To me, if you're a big company and you want to come and do business in Canada, you know, taxation is how we keep the infrastructure on which you're relying. So to me, that's really, you know, it's kind of scandalous that that's the model they adopt.
What about on a city level, the effect on things like equal access to transportation? For instance, you know, access for disabled people to get into a cab.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where I'm not. Uber has been a big subject in Ontario recently. You know, Toronto, Ottawa, and even where I am in KW, you know, that's been the hot topic. I know Airbnb has been a big topic in Vancouver, but here it's been Uber for the last little while. And it's a problematic thing because I think we all know that taxi industry has been far from a perfect industry. You know, it's traditionally in many big cities been an industry where largely immigrant men have had to work very long hours for very little money. Excuse me. So it's not that that's a perfect industry, to compare it with. But I think what we have to think is, you know, one of the reasons for regulations of the taxi industry has been that local governments have had to hold that industry's feet to the fire to get them to behave in a proper way in terms of accessibility, in terms of equal access for people in different parts of cities and so on. So they've had to put those regulations in place. Now Uber comes along and says, you don't need that, we'll take care of it. But they have exactly the same reasons as the regular taxi industry to squeeze the drivers when they can, which they can, to cut corners on accessibility because that's expensive and awkward to do. So there have been plenty of cases of, you know, Uber drivers being charged with not taking blind people, not taking service dogs, and so on. There are court cases in the U.S. and there are court cases in the U.K. on that kind of issue. I don't know why cities seem to think that moving away from taxis and giving business to Uber is going to solve these problems. They're going to remain problems, and Uber is going to be a real challenge to deal with when it comes to accessibility and universal access.
Well, Tom, it's a wonderful book, and we've really just touched the surface. There's so much in there. I really enjoyed reading it, but I don't want to let you go without asking about the fact that the story of sharing and community and personal over corporate relations has obviously struck a chord. Where can we look to see a genuine sharing economy?
Well, it's a good question, and I think you're absolutely right. It does strike a chord, and it has struck a chord, and there is to some extent a generational appeal to it as well, I think, but there are attempts in places around North America and elsewhere to have, for example, a more cooperatively owned structure. There was a conference in New York just before Christmas on a thing called platform cooperativism, which is a notion that, you know, maybe we can build these kind of services, maybe we can take advantage of some of the technologies that they use, but maybe we can actually have it cooperatively owned as opposed to pushed by venture capital. I think there's a lot of questions as to whether that's going to be a successful model or not, but in the end, this is a problem that will be solved by experimentation and people taking some chances, you know, not by me sitting and reflecting on it. So I think it is sparking a number of attempts for people to say, you know what, this has gone wrong, but there are some possibilities here for genuine community services. And maybe they'll be smaller scale, maybe they'll be more local, but, you know, with luck, some of those things will turn into real successes.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you this morning, Tom. Thank you so much.
Rain, for your attention and your interest.
I've been speaking with Tom Slee. He's the author of What's Yours is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy, and he blogs at tomslee.net.